are active on Facebook. 83% of people 33 years or younger in the United States are engaged in social networking platforms. In November 2010, Facebook accounted for 1 out of every 4 American web page views. Its membership grows at a rate of about 700,000 people a day. In 2003, the Home Office found that 20% of people in the UK had contact with a friend or neighbour less than once a month. Fewer than half of Britons expressed trust in the people in their own neighbourhoods, and only 30% agreed that most people can be trusted. What is friendship? What is community? And how is social media affecting these? My name is Joel Harrison, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the 4th Annual Veritas Forum at Oxford University, the Social Networkers. Across universities in North America, Europe, and here in the United Kingdom, students and faculty gather under the banner of Veritas to step outside of our various disciplinary niches and consider questions that challenge us all. We hope to contribute to this by bringing the life and story of Jesus of Nazareth into conversation with different worldviews. Our goal, that all of us will be stirred to greater reflection and ongoing conversation on a topic pressing in its contemporary significance. Tonight, we turn our attention to a modern revolution. In the well-known movie whose title we have nuanced, Justin Timberlake's character declares with the look of a zealot, "We lived on farms, then we lived in cities, and now we're going to live on the internet." As the figures bear out, our living on the internet is increasingly taking place through social network systems. Platforms like Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, PostSecret.com, virtual worlds like Second Life and InView allow us to construct a public or semi-public profile that can then connect with other users for various purposes. Forming interest groups, chat, disclosure of secrets, declarations of an engagement, declarations of how many books, movies, or destinations on a top 100 list you have achieved. Sharing information and product placements. Forming relationships, virtual marriages and virtual sexual encounters. Friendships and possibly creating a community. The skeptics and the evangelists of social networking are both, we believe, these developments give rise to a series of tensions. Our conception of privacy is changing, resulting in an increased willingness or compulsion to reveal more and more about ourselves, laying bare our souls. At the same time, we have stories of teenagers and university students taking days to craft a Facebook profile and anxiously worrying about the level of activity on their social network. We expand our network, our cache of friends, engaging with people from different countries and walks of life. But, as the Pew Forum discovered, liberals continue to flock to liberals, conservatives to conservatives, while people feel validated by interest-based networks, from hobbies to the proliferation of self-harm groups. Social network systems facilitate arguably a desire for intimacy. We can maintain relationships across cultures or form new, easier friendships with strangers. But many have nevertheless expressed a feeling of being alone, distanced from people by the very technology that promises connection. In 1177, a 17-year-old French shepherd boy named Benazet began the only bridge he ever attempted, a bridge between two warring countries. His work of mercy earned him a new name, Saint Benazet, the Bridge Builder. In 2010, Time magazine named the creator and president of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, Person of the Year. This modern-day builder identifies his aims as openness and connection, transparency in the world and the ability to remain in touch. Technology, arguably, has always been loaded with human purposes, and so we can ask, do social network systems serve the ends of friendship and community? For tonight's discussion, we are joined by speakers from diverse backgrounds, an evolutionary anthropologist, an executive of a popular social media platform, and a theologian. You'll find in your programs a full biography for each speaker and the order of the evening. Each speaker will have 10 minutes to address the questions I've raised. What is friendship and community? How are they affected by social media? And what is the relevance of Christian tradition? This will be followed by a moderated discussion and then questions from the audience. We begin with Professor Robin Dunbar. Professor Dunbar is the Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology at Magdalen College. and Director of the School of Anthropology's Institute of Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology. A Fellow of the British Academy, he has written and edited numerous books. Most recently, How Many Friends Does a Person Need? Dunbar's Number and Other Evolutionary Quirks. Please join me in welcoming Professor Dunbar.
So old that I was born before the internet. In fact, when I did my PhD thesis many years ago, we had to use gold pens. Well, actually, typewriters, but people are far off. The internet, there's no question, it has changed everything we do, not only in the research world, but right down to social. And I guess, you know, when email really became kind of global, if you like, and then subsequently the social networking sites like Facebook and the like, the kind of promise from the techies, if I may use it, or such, was that they were going to create the global village. And there is a kind of sense in which that's true. But I guess I'm not the cyber pessimist then, as the kind of cyber optimist, cyber pessimist dimension, in the sense that at least from what we see about the nature of relationships that people actually have, it's very difficult to create a kind of online universe for yourself which actually is bigger than the one you would normally live in your real everyday life. And that seems to be because of two key things. One is a cognitive constraint on the number of friends you can have, even by Facebook's definition of friends. And the other is a time limitation and how we actually create virtues. So the cognitive side goes back to the fact that we share with our nearest and dearest cousins, the monkey snakes, a general relationship which relates social group size to the size, particularly of the neocortex, and particularly probably of the more functional parts of the neocortex. That actually sets a limit on the number of relationships you can have. Now that relationship varies species to species, and we're at the top end, we have very big brains, and that allows us to have very big social groups and communities. And the number for us is about 150. That's what's become known as Dunbar's Number. And I have to say, I have to thank Facebook. Because it was a discussion on Facebook by Facebook users about the fact that there are so many, I've got all these people signed up, I don't know who half of them are. And somebody apparently blogged in and said, there's this guy who simply says that there's a limit on the number of friends you can have. Kind of, and it got christened Dunbar's Number by the user of the conference on Facebook. So if you're one of them, thank you very much. You made my career. In a sense, however, that 150 is simply the number of people you can have kind of reciprocated relationships with. So these are the people who, if you ask them to do you a favour, or you just ask them to go out and have a certain evening with you, would have some kind of sense of reciprocity and would kind of say, yeah, or maybe we haven't seen each other for ages, or let's do it. It's not the only the number of people you know. As it turns out, our social world really consists of a series of layers, which are very tightly scaled. It's really quite ironic. These layers occur successively at about 5 people, 15 people, 50 people, 150 people, and we know they go on to 2 more layers at least, 500 and 1500. And incidentally, since we're in this august space of learning, I might point out, because it just demonstrates that we haven't learned anything in science since 350 BC, Aristotle was the first layer. So the number of true friends you can count on fingers of one hand. And Plato figured the next layer out. He said the ideal democracy size, and you might remember that when you go to the next election, is 5,300. Now, I allowed him 300 error bearings on that. Statistics, it should be 5,000. But the point about these layers is, and these are successively inclusive, so the kind of 50 includes the 5 within that. But the point is, the layers increase in number, but they decrease in the quality of the relationship. And that makes a huge difference, it turns out, to how how you see people. And as you extend out beyond the 150, you get into layers of people who you know, you recognize them. I mean, they may be just the president or the queen or the person who recently used on evening television. You've seen them. And then you put a name to their face. But believe me, if you wandered over and rang them up and said, fancy going out for beer tonight, you'd probably get quite a frosty response. And that's a very different kind of response to the response you get from people inside the 150. So you can have 1,500, you can have 5,000 people on your Facebook page if you want. But my argument, if you like, to you is everybody beyond 150 is just voyeurs and impersonal. And the reason is that to have a real close relationship of some kind with a person requires the investment of a huge amount of time and effort. And that time and effort is mostly concentrated on the inner layers. We spend something in approaching 60% of our kind of social effort on the inner core of five people, our five very best friends, if you like. And decreasing quantities as you go up. And that has a huge effect on the sense of intimacy. We can show that the sense of emotional closeness is dependent on how much time we invest. So much so, and perhaps I should point out that for almost everybody here, your network of 150 is split into two parts, family and friends. If you come from a big family, you don't have many friends, it turns out. You give priority to family. And one of the reasons for that is family relationships can't come for free. These people will lay down their lives for you, come what may. But friends are different, friends are fragile, and if you don't invest time with them, they won't lay down their lives for you. At the end of the day, it's only the ones that you really are deeply engaged with, that inner core of five, maybe 15, those two layers. So much so, we did a longitudinal study of a small sample, actually, of people looking at how their friendships change when they move away from home and went to university. And those friends, but not family, that they spent less time interacting with plummeted dramatically and typically dropped down a whole layer in this sort of series of expanding circles of friendship. And I think it goes back to the fact that really most of the time our relationships are based on a very small circle we spend most of our time with. And we forget just how small that circle actually is.
And one of the kind of comments that's been made about Facebook users and so on is that actually most of the time that you think you're just talking to two or three people on there. And just to leave you with one statistic of how much that's so, one of the things we were interested in how people use mobile technology and social networking sites to kind of ameliorate the decline in friendships as people move away and don't have a chance to see each other. And one of the astonishing for us, it's not going to surprise everybody under 25, but believe me, it astonishes me and it astonishes most of the older folk. We had, out of our sample, we had three kids there who sent an average over 18 months of 100 texts a day. Right? They were, one of the interesting things is they were doing A-levels at the time. And what we haven't done yet is see if there's an inverse correlation between the number of texts sent and A-levels. But what was really interesting about that was that of those 100, and this was generally true for across this whole sample, but what was the case was of these 100-plus texts a day that they were sending, 85% were just to two people, best boyfriend and best girlfriend. So in a sense, our social world really is very, very small scale. And so that's the kind of downside of it. I'll just end on the upside by saying that in the context of that, where I think Facebook and the other social networking sites have kind of hit a market is the fact that because we now live such a mobile life and disperse all over the place, what they've picked up on is that opportunity to keep those friendships going over distance. But I have to say, I think there are two problems they have to solve yet. From our research, we've been able to show that what's critical to the sense of quality of an interaction is how much you laugh on it. And the other thing that's probably much more important than we realise is virtual touch, because these relationships are emotional things. We can't express them in words very well. It's just something we feel or we recognise other people are having a relationship. And what that's largely about is actually physical touch. And I reckon until Facebook solves the problem of virtual touch, they won't get the $1 million mark. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Dunbar. Our second speaker, Ms. Jenny Rutherford, has flown over from Palo Alto, California, to be with us. She is Head of Strategic Marketing for InView. InView is a 3D graphical social network that allows users to create avatars, to chat, interact, and engage in trading or purchasing in order to improve their environment or cultivate their avatar. It has more than 50 million registered users. Previously, Ms. Rutherford served as Vice President of Marketing at Oodle, which entailed building and launching businesses for Facebook. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Rutherford.
Hi, good evening. It's evening, right? Thank you for having me here today. I'm operating on a little bit of a different time zone, so hopefully I won't fall asleep while I'm speaking. Before I go any further, I'd really like to take a moment to really define social media. According to Wikipedia, social media uses highly accessible and scalable communication technologies, which turn web-based and mobile technologies into interactive dialogues. They're really a blending of technology and social interactions for the value of the world. So Facebook has over 500 million users. It took the radio 38 years to reach 50 million users. That is absolutely amazing. It took TV 13 years, the internet 4 years, and it took Facebook reached 50 million users in less than 9 months, which is an absolute amazing phenomena. There are over 25 billion pieces of content shared every month. If Facebook were a country, it would be the third largest country in the world. People spend over 700 billion minutes per month on Facebook. Clearly, people value the ability to communicate one-to-many and to create relationships and communities in a way that were never possible before. To me, social media is like the Matrix. As Morpheus said, unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. No matter how academic, theoretical, philosophical, or theological we try to make social media, it is really up to you to do with it what you want to do. You do not have to take a red pill to understand social media. You just have to try it for yourself, and you will see the matrix clearly for yourself. When you engage deeply with it and it with you, it will open a world of possibilities for you and for the world around you. Some social media tools allowing you to connect one-to-many where all the participants are fully known and transparent are things such as Facebook and Twitter. Others, such as InView, are focused on social entertainment, which allow users the ability to create and design avatars and interact in a 3D community and environment. They allow you to anonymously and still yet communicate broadly to build community with friends and people that you don't know. Social media allows you to connect with communities that you have shared interests and experiences with, even those that are geographically dispersed throughout the world. Whereas traditional media hasn't done a good job of serving all communities and geography typically limits relationships, social media includes Facebook and Twitter includes companies such as InView and Foursquare, where you can broadcast your location. I don't think Foursquare is in the UK yet, but you'll probably see it coming in the next 8 to 10 months or so. Color and Path. Unlike Facebook, these four companies enable you to have interactions with people that you don't know, yet build community with these people. For the past several years, I've been living and breathing in social media through my work at Facebook and also at InView. One of the things that attracted me to InView was really my fascination around the topic of anonymity versus transparency. In a world where social media is both transparent and anonymous, the first time I went to use InView, I went into a chat room and had an amazing experience that changed my life forever. The discussion was with a woman from the Middle East. The discussion went something like the woman talking to me about how she was shrouded from head to toe in clothing, and when she was online at InView, she really became alive. She became the person that she wanted to be in life. And although her real identity was anonymous, the quality and consistency of the friendship she developed with people that she met in this anonymous virtual world were things that kept her spirit alive. Furthermore, if people in her country knew what she was doing, she could have been persecuted. Just because you've never met a person does not mean you cannot have an authentic relationship with them. It is really up to you to decide how you want to cultivate that relationship and how you want to use it to better the community. Then what is the rank of friendship within different social media channels? This is a topic that's of high interest right now in Silicon Valley. Is a relationship on Facebook more important than a relationship with a complete stranger that you've never met? Friendship has multiple levels, and multiple levels and multiple depths. Its depths depend on what you're looking for and how much you're willing to put into it. For the Middle Eastern woman that I met online, her relationships with her friends on InView were unique and provided her with something that she could not get elsewhere. It seems a bit historically curious to be here talking about social media and the social media revolution, especially since there's not a newspaper or a smartphone revolution, there's not an iPad revolution, to which I'll point out that there's not a Lady Gaga revolution. But yes, if you look at the Facebook pages with the most engagement, they are not Lady Gaga and Justin Bieber. They are Jesus Daily, followed by the Bible, Lady Gaga, Justin Bieber, and then Manchester United is a distant sixth. Religious pages get the most engagement on Facebook today. Being immersed in Silicon Valley again for the past 20 years and being exposed to the latest and greatest technologies, I really find myself in a quandary about whether or not there's really a revolution going on or not. I don't need to state the obvious, which is that social media is creating communication explosion and changing our lives forever. The topics of Facebook and Twitter alone seem a little bit mundane to me. So is social media really a revolution, an evolution, or is it just a tool? Social media is not a revolution in and of itself, but it is part of a broader technological revolution that has been accelerating over the last decade. Smartphones and social media have been instrumental to the Arab Spring revolutions of 2011, though there is some debate about social media's role in the changes of the speed at which the news of the revolution has traveled around the world. It has been instant, and no one can debate that that news traveled at light speed in a way that was never possible before. We've watched in real time as decades of old dictatorships have crumbled, something that none of us in our generation have ever seen live. In many countries, there are now more cell phones than people. For example, Russia has 1.5 phones per resident. Communication within society has really evolved from one-to-one to one-to-many. Until the rise of social media, it only used to be that you would talk on the phone to one person. Now social media allows you to talk from one to many. Previously, those who owned traditional media outlets held a monopoly on communication. Now everyone is a personal news station. Social media has been democratized and has liberated communication. Social media is morally neutral and religiously agnostic. It can be used for good and it can be used for evil. It is all about how it gets used. A car can be used to run someone over, but yet it can be used to take someone to the hospital. It's just a tool. You don't stop using your car because someone else might use theirs to run you over. Take the Neolithic Revolution, the first agricultural movement that brought cultivated crops to the world, yet it also brought disease and war and famine. Would we do it all over again? Of course. It also allowed civilization to develop, towns and cities to form, and eventually cities to flourish. With all technology, there are choices. And with choices, it matters how you choose to use them. Around the Christmas holiday this past year, there was a two-year-old who our family knew very well who was dying of cancer, a really rare form of cancer that only a couple of people in the U.S. had. One of her last wishes was to see Santa Claus. I posted on my Facebook account that I was looking for a Santa Claus suit, and within 20 minutes, I had 15 responses. My father-in-law picked up the Santa suit and arrived at her doorstep in less than 2 hours. This would not have been possible a decade ago. Of course, there are many downsides to social media as well. Most of the companies are for-profit entities. We'd like to think they're very altruistic and want to build social media because they love it, because they're passionate about it and they're excited about it. And while there are some entrepreneurs that feel that way, it is still a for-profit business. And people are certainly trying to build the largest possible social graph and taking that social graph and really trying to monetize it. Another area of concern is the amount of data that companies know about you today. It's absolutely unbelievable. Who are your friends? Where did you grow up? Did you buy a box of Kleenex 24 hours before you watched the royal wedding 10 times? What kind of brand of underwear are you wearing today? Additionally, it is not just the amount, but the length of the data that is stored. Everything you post on the internet, especially, lasts forever. It is out there in the stream. You'll be able to access that data for years to come. Nothing is private anymore, even though that you think it is. For example, after you graduate from Oxford, suppose you're looking for a job. Your potential employer Googles you and finds that a friend of yours had posted a picture of you drinking pints of beer one evening. Does this influence how they think about you? Yes, potentially. The technology of social media today has really accelerated the pace of change and innovation in a way that our society has never seen before. Ray Kurzweil talks about the concept of technology singularity, where humans and technology start to merge together, after which the magnitude and pace of which this change magnifies. We're not there yet, but technology and social media are demonstrating rapid change, innovation, and impact. There would be no social media without the technology to use it. The horse and carriage, the Model T, took decades to change the world. Facebook, Twitter, and smartphones exploded in a couple of years and are changing the world. Social media enables communication and in friendship. It is a communication tool, a utility. How you use it, what you do with it, it is entirely up to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rutherford. Our third speaker, Professor Graham Ward, is Ferguson Professor of Philosophical Theology and Ethics and Head of the School of Arts, Histories and Cultures at the University of Manchester. He has written and edited numerous books, the most recent being The Politics of Discipleship, Becoming Post-Material Citizens. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ward.
I want to take a slightly different angle on Joel's three questions because I want to begin with what I think is an even more fundamental question. And it's a question that draws all the various topics that we're actually looking at this evening, friendship, community, the social, communication or media, into a single constellation. And that question is, what is it to belong? The question is also foundational to religion, for the origins of that word in the Latin verb itself, religiae, is to bind. And furthermore, two of the most important terms within religion, certainly within the Christian religion, are related to that binding. So, for example, you've got the Greek ecclesia, which was a political assembly, citizens participating in local government, or a corps of soldiers with a specific mandate for action. And the Greek term liturgia, from which we get the word liturgy, was an act of civil service or benevolence. So what I'm looking at then is the practices in which belongings exercised and through which that exercise community is constituted. But by that question, what I wish to get at is something that I think is even more primordial than the exercises themselves. For what is it that draws us to belonging, to joining, say, a social network, or a union, or a political party, or a local church? Now, I can see that all those are different forms of association, but I'm wondering about a more fundamental aspect of the human condition. We like to congregate, we like to associate, not always, but with some regularity, we meet up and keep up in contact with family and friends. And those people who have no family and no friends, we actually tend to pity on the whole. We're not islands. Why? I've emphasized we like to congregate. Because I want to get beneath the actual Christmas parties or the union meetings or the chat rooms into what is the embodied need, the embodied urge the embodied drive behind it, the desire that persists throughout the histories of the various technological means by which we communicate. Indeed, is it possible this desire which galvanizes the pursuit for advanced and better forms of communication in the face of ideologies and sometimes social conditions which threaten belonging, and so we have to overcome those obstacles? Let me say just something more about those threats, because they provide the context in which I think we need to understand the revolutionary aspects of social media. Post-Second World War experience in the West, particularly in Western Europe, has been one of secularization, evident in the decline of church attendance and the rise of what sociologists like Grace Davey will call believing without belonging. This not belonging, which Davies characterizes as evident in the relations between church and society, has a far broader trajectory than just the historical basis of post-Second World War Europe and the US. Its historical roots lie in the call for greater moral autonomy, the subjective individualism in the Enlightenment, which led to what someone like Charles Taylor will call the great disembedding of social atomism. Now, this not belonging most recently has been the topic of particular interest to one major sociologist, and that's Robert Putnam. And he talks about the decline in social capital. There's been a lot of debate about his methods and the results he's coming up with. But what he is actually saying is that increasingly we are becoming fragmented and people are taking an opt-out position. To use his metaphor, we are increasingly bowling alone, evident in the decline of various civic associations, professional associations, political engagement. In fact, if he's right, then the church or the mosque or the temple or the synagogue and its liturgies actually are probably some of the most resistant forms of that dissolving of the collective, and have probably been more resistant in that deterioration then of belonging, the erosion of social capital. So, okay, what we do inhabit then, according to these people, are conditions and ideologies inimical to friendship, inimical to community, and to the social as such. Nevertheless, and I've got to be brief here, nevertheless, what we've actually seen as being part of the postmodern paradox is that while all this not belonging is going on, while all this liquidation of social capital is going on, we have never more been in touch with each other through telecommunications. Skype, email, online chat rooms, multiple domains, you name it, iPod. We have never been so much in communication with each other or in the recovery of old associations. Now, sometimes what I actually like to call this is virtual accumulation capital. And I call it that because it is a capital. This kind of social networking has power. Jenny talked about the power that it has to topple dictators. In this country, the organization of student riots in London took place through mobile phones, contacting people. It wasn't necessarily done, and not effectively done, through unions or through posters. Back or virtual association capital does have power, and it does have value, because it has the value and capacity to actually change things. What we also have to do is to recognise that neither networks nor virtual communities are new phenomena. A number of anthropologists and cultural philosophers have drawn attention to how the mediatisation of reality that has been going on for centuries, that mediatisation is always going to mean that we belong to a certain extent to virtual communities. So, in fact, belonging today is an effect not just of face-to-face association, but also of multiple forms of mediation, newspapers, television, internet, etc. So let me turn then to this point that I'm trying to make, which is the central point and the only one I can actually make here. The desire for association, the desire to belong, for community, persists even when current ideologies, social conditions, and social practices seem to militate against its survival. And so I want to ask, why this persistence? What is it to belong? To what extent, then, is belonging some kind of anthropological a priori? And let me just come on that then to talk about the theological, because there are various ways in which you can understand anthropological a priori. But belonging as a theological anthropological a priori is usually based on a reading of the scriptures, particularly in Genesis, to do with the imago Dei, the image of God, that we were created in the image of God. Now, someone like Karl Barth will say that therefore when we treat human beings, because human beings are male and female, he will say that therefore what is human being is not one person, it is always the relationship that what that one person has with another person. But then even an older tradition, theologians like Augustine, which actually take account of that notion of the image of God, say therefore because God is triune, because God in God's self lives in and as a societas, from which we get the word friendship, because of the triune nature of divine love and activity and operations in the world, then because we are made in the image of God, we too are social animals of that kind. And so our belonging will always issue on the theological understanding of an anthropological a priori. It will always issue in friendship and in kinship, no matter what the technologies are there to actually help or assist or actually prevent that. So the theological conception of belonging for Augustine or Aquinas is this natural inclination in which we want to congregate and we desire to form community. And at that point, I'm going to stop.
This is now the part of the evening where I get to ask whatever's been battering around in my head for a while. So if I can begin, I want to pick up on two points. This issue of moral neutrality in technology and this issue of desire. If I can turn to Ms. Rutherford first. Your argument that social networks are morally neutral, they are a tool. In contrast, could it be said that they are designed for some human purpose, namely to satisfy a desire or a particular vision of human relationships, and what would that particular vision be?
So I definitely think there's a human vision aspect to social media in the sense that social media's conception came out of someone who wanted to broadcast something more globally. It came out of the desire to build some community and to get affirmation around the community they were building. That said, I really do think that the tool of social media in itself can be used in a variety of different ways. Both good and bad. You can use it to make it morally, by itself it's morally neutral, but if you influence it, it becomes morally in the direction that you need it to be headed. But as the tool in itself, it's a neutral tool.
Right. Professor Dunbar, if we can continue with this theme, your opinion on the argument that this technology is in itself morally neutral. And I'm also interested, you talked about broadcasting again, and it's another theme that Ms. Rutherford's just picked up on, and the idea that we now have voyeurs to our life. How does that fit in potentially with this idea of moral neutrality of the technology?
Oh, I think there's no issue. I mean, in general, anything to do with science and technology in and of itself, is by definition morally neutral. It's how we use it that makes it moral, right? But outside that, the distinction I'm just going to draw, I think, is between your use of these social networking sites and the technology to build and maintain and service the relationships that you have as personal relationships, and the use of the technology, what it permits in terms of kind of broadcasting to very wide audiences. The example from Twitter that you referred to, you know, and that's kind of like a lighthouse just blinking away, and maybe somebody will see it and maybe somebody won't, but it clearly can be used, and used very effectively, as we've seen, to generate movements or create things. But those, what's involved in those at the end of the day are not personal relationships. That's a kind of different thing altogether. And I want to draw a clear distinction between that, I think. And, you know, in a sense, both of them, they have inevitably their moral dimension. You can abuse or, you know, not your friends as you see fit, face-to-face and on Facebook. And you can, you know, obviously use something like Twitter or the wider capacities, the broadcast capacities, in the same sort of way. And that's your choice.
I would never abuse my friends. Professor Ward, your views on this idea that the technology itself can be morally neutral, whether it actually cultivates a particular vision of human flourishing. And I want to put that again into the context of, we've heard the word voyeurs, broadcast, and also Professor Dunbar said that it's removed from touch.
Obviously, it's removed from touch. I want to come back to something about why I would question whether it was morally neutral. And that is that I think we have a very kind of peculiar philosophical understanding of tools if we just see them in terms of their use. Because in some ways, tools are an extension of ourselves and are created as extensions of ourselves. I'm trying to think of the way in which, you know, we invent something like a shovel because it can actually do something more effectively than what our hands do. But we actually are physically holding that tool and using that tool. So there's a lot of work done in the way that the tools shouldn't be seen as just objects that are out there. That in fact there is an interaction, a social interaction that goes on with tools. And I think there's still some work that I would like to see in terms of, you know, what is happening then to these users, or what is happening to the users of these, of social networks as a particular tool. Because I don't think they cannot be changed in some way by that. I agree that on the ethical side, it will be a matter of the morality question comes about the use of it, but I think that there is not that kind of, oh, it's the use of an object that's out there. It's not. Particularly because a lot of the social networks are highly interactive, and that therefore there's not that gap between the subject and the object in the same way that you would want if you just said, oh, the tool is out there. You are actually part of the production of what's actually going on here.
What about the, just the second point I was making there, one of the themes here was voyeur and broadcasting, and does that contrast at all with what you were talking about in terms of the image of the triune God?
I don't think it does necessarily. I mean, we're just using terms here which are, if you like, loaded. For example, you take something like some of the medieval worldview. The medieval worldview would have the eye of God in some of the pictures that it actually had. In other words, all surveillance is doing, or voyeurism is doing, God is the biggest voyeur of all. All right? And it's not, it's just a matter of the terms that we're actually using.
Right.
So I think just because we actually start to use terms that have a kind of moral quality, you know, I think we've got to understand what we're actually talking about here.
If I can stay with you for a moment, Professor Ward, and ask, Ms. Rutherford referred to InView and how she was attracted to it through its anonymity and the ability to engage in a play of self-identity. It seems online we're able to do that in increasing ways. Is this self-presentation or cultivation of identity online a problem, or is it, for example, simply what we always do? And is there actually a Christian perspective on this?
There's not a Christian perspective on anything. Not that all Christians, I think, would actually agree with unanimously. But it does seem to me that, in fact, let's take the prime Christian account, the account of your conversion, how you came to God. I've never met anyone who has given the same testimony twice in the same way. In other words, you always relate to people differently, and what you show of yourself to different people is different. It may all constitute what you are as a person, but in fact, the kind of what you say to them and what you're actually... And so doing it online and through anonymity, that doesn't seem to worry me at all. It's just one other form of relating. It would worry me if somebody didn't actually have any face-to-face relationships whatsoever, and one was just a complete substitute for the other. You know, you're reaching a certain pathological state at that point. But in fact, you know, some of the research that I'm really interested in the way in which people who have been involved in these have increased senses of their own happiness, increased senses of their own control of their lives, or an increased sense of their creativity in creating friends. Sometimes, and we've all known this, sometimes a certain view of you by other people can be very, very imprisoning. And to actually being able to actually not, to actually be come out of that altogether can be a liberation.
Professor Dunbar, this idea of identity presentation and construction online, do you find it normal, problematic from the standpoint of friendship, community?
I think the issue is actually that if you look at traditional societies, small-scale traditional societies, what you find typically there, and you still find it, and you find it in small rural communities, and you know, in America and Europe just as much, I suspect, is that everybody is everybody else's 150, as it were. They all overlap. So you have a real sense of community binding because everybody knows everybody else, and they're all kind of deeply bound together. The problem with that is anybody who's lived in those kind of communities will tell you it's deeply cloying. Everybody knows your business. What's happened really, I guess, increasingly for us since probably the Second World War onwards, this increasing economic mobility where we're constantly moving around has led to our networks being kind of fractionated and distributed geographically. So you kind of, I don't know, let's say you're born in London, you come to a university in Oxford, you get a job in Edinburgh, you know, then they send you to Silicon Valley for a couple of years, and all the way along the line you're picking up groups of friends. The family is always constant, but you're picking up groups of friends who then don't know each other. So in that context you can maintain different persona to each of them. You know, you can be the lovely son or daughter back home and the tearaway with your friends and the model employee with the people you work with. And I think one of the shockers that came up with people with Facebook is they didn't realise that this was going on. Suddenly everybody saw you, including Granny. And in some sense that's kind of good, because I think it's reinstating what I not call the global village, because I don't think it's global. You're reinstating the internet village. It's your village being recreated and reintegrated as a communal whole. But at the end of the day, I suppose my worry in this context is if you're online all the time, and this is probably important with friends, because friends change, you know, your friends change, your cohort of friends change over your life. And if you keep trying to maintain contact with those friends you had at 15 to 20 or something like that, and all your investment in social capital is going into them, you're not meeting new people, and that's a bad thing. Because the one thing I will tell all of you now, because this has been my experience, is the friends you meet at this age at university, you can pick up with again in 40 years' time as though you'd met them the day before. It's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It's the friends after that you want to worry about, because they are very much more fragile.
Right. Jenny, if you want to respond to any of this, I take it your views are much the same on this idea of online identity construction.
So definitely. I also think that you're smart, educated students. You're not going to sit in your dorm room all day long tweeting to people and posting on your Facebook account, right?
Well.
Let's meet
for... Should we do a show of hands?
Let's meet for coffee on Facebook. So really, I think it's a matter of in moderation how much time you spend on Facebook. And again, I don't think anything at all, any technology replaces the social interaction you can have with someone in person. I think that's just an absolute invaluable experience that you can have. But I do think that there's an opportunity to maintain connections with people that you may not be able to connect with on a daily basis and still have meaningful relationships with those people. Do I think it's possible to have meaningful relationships with 150, 200 people at a time? No, I don't. But again, it's like going into a party. You go into a party, there's 50 people in the room, and you pick a couple people that you're connecting with while you're in the party, and I think it's the same sort of thing.
I think I should play a little devil's advocate here and just reference to Professor Sherry Turkle's Alone Together book, MIT professor. And she, although you think this audience won't Twitter their coffees, she writes about people that are a little younger than us that have basically grown into yes. Facebook. They haven't ever had the option to opt in or opt out. And she writes about teenagers who no longer want to use the phone mm-hmm. because the phone is a little too allows for random conversation. They will no longer go next door. When they come home from school, they will pull out their phone and they'll do thousands of texts a month, and they will be on Skype and on Facebook chat at the same time. There seems to be, as you get younger, potentially a removal from physical interaction. Professor Ward, is that, I mean, the idea you said, embodied desire, for instance, was a term you used.
Well, that's what I mean, that these are, they're highly interactive tools, and that therefore it's not just that we can actually use them or not use them. I mean, the internet is more like an environment, and it's obviously that these people now are growing up within that environment where this is the way it's accepted that they should interact with each other. But I still want to actually question, do they not go to school? There must be some level. Do they not have parents? You know, there must be some level.
Apparently most of their parents are on BlackBerry at the dinner table.
But I know that even in institutions like my own university, people will email each other rather than telephone.
Right. Mm. Anyone else on this removal from the physical interaction? Ms. Rutherford.
On that point, I do think that they will email instead of pick up the phone, but part of it is also a convenience factor. Mm. Email's right here, I have my iPhone, takes me 5 seconds to do this. Boom, I'm done. But back to your question about a younger generation, I think it's going to be more concerning for younger kids, 20 and under, and I think it's going to be becoming increasingly more important for parents to be really educated about what social media means, to set limits and parameters, and to also act as good role models to their children. Prime example, I have a 2-year-old I was putting down for bed last week, and she said, "Just a minute, Mom, I need to send a text," as I'm putting her down to bed. Well, if she's getting that from me. So I need to be better at role modeling to her what's appropriate and what's not. And she was 2. Bad parent.
Professor Dunbar, if I can...
It's good spelling.
If I can... if I can shift it along a little bit here and reference back to your idea you mentioned a couple of times about this global village. I open with the statistics of 20% of the people, 20% of people in the UK not having contact with a friend or neighbour. They have contact less than once a month. And we're familiar with similar statistics, and Professor Ward mentioned them, decline in trade union membership, political participation, churches. In your most recent book, you write of neglecting community at our own peril, and you point to religion as functionally serving social cohesion in our evolutionary history. Do you think social network systems can be forms of community that perhaps act as a replacement for traditional forms?
No.
Right, so...
for the reason that... And this kind of goes back to the point I was making about virtual touch, and I think the point both of you were making also, that at the end of the day... And we don't know. I mean, this is one of the kind of interesting things. We're living through a huge experiment now with things like Facebook and the like. We don't know how people who've grown up in that environment will actually turn out as sort of old fogies and the like. And we certainly don't know how, you know, the upcoming generations yet to be born who are going to you know, be thrown right in against turnout. And I guess my worry in that context is the way we find our way about the social world really is a consequence of our experiences in the sandpit, as it were. You know, face-to-face interactions with each other. We learn these very subtle kind of handling of other people, and you know, not how far you can push them and how far you shouldn't push them, and these kind of things. And I worry that the technology isn't sophisticated enough to allow that, because you have a distance from them. If you know, if you offend me on Facebook, actually I'm not on Facebook. I'm the only person in the world that isn't. And I tend to stay that way. you know, if you sort of say some, you know, mild aside, which is sort of, you know, I take as an insult, I can just close you down and walk away and say I'm never going to talk to you again. But in a face-to-face contact, we kind of read the subtlety of how perhaps the thing wasn't intended to be an insult, it was a little bit of a joke, and all these kind of subtleties. And I think my worry is, I guess, if you don't have that experience as a child, and a lot of it, mm-hmm. You risk ending up as an adult who is not very good at handling other people. And we are social. Just as you said, we have to live in a community. And our big problem now, I think, is increasing urbanisation. This is putting enormous stresses on how we get on and live together. And boy, have we got to solve that problem and create a sense of a global community out of a machinery which was never designed to do that. That's this stuff up here. You know, it's not very good at handling very large community sizes.
I think that I don't think we should, in our socialising or our notions of socialising, just think it does come through that face-to-face, and it does come through the sandpit and learning to read the cues from other people. But in fact, in our own socialising, there's been a lot of the virtual in there. We are socialised by reading books.
Sure.
You know, the socialisation is also part of our imaginative development, yeah, and our creative, yeah, development, and that's not just been through imitation of behaviours of others. That's also been through response to reading novels or watching films or listening to music or other things that have actually also developed, yeah, which are not. I agree The realm of touch is there, and the realm of socialising, parents still play, physical friends still play an important part. But there's a lot that's actually worked out in our socialising through our, yeah, imaginations and our emotions. Yeah. And the pedagogy of imagination and emotions is not just through these means, it's through other virtual, mediatized, mm-hmm, means.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that's sort of the issue. And if you think of, I'll take the example of romantic relationships, because they are virtual relationships most of the time for us. In other words, until reality sets in. Right? So what seems to happen, this is what this peculiar phenomenon of falling in love is all about. You know, the red sunglasses come down, it looks wonderfully and rosy, and it takes you a little while to really get to know the person. You are living in that virtual world, and I think all that the kind of, you know, internet and the like, digital media are doing is just removing a little bit of the brakes that in normal everyday face-to-face interaction you would kind of look and say, you know, if I invite her out, will she say yes or no, you know. On the internet and email, this is the classic with email, you know, you don't have that. So what you're falling in love with is utterly in here, when in fact it's some 15-year-old spammer in a village. You know, and it's because you don't have that kind of interaction. It's not to say everybody's doing that, as you rightly pointed out, but the fact is it's easy to exploit the technology for those purposes. And so you have endless problems as people, you know, in internet scam romances cost billions, and people's, you know, sort of emotional mental health and emotional lives.
I'm going to, keeping my eagle eye on the clock, kick it out to the audience now. I think there are two roving mics. If you're up on the top there, can I suggest if you want to ask a question, you make your way down to the centre aisle here. I'll ask you to keep your questions brief, and please make sure they are indeed a question. So, Rachel and And Mary, I think, is somewhere. So is there someone for a first question? You got a mic.
Peter? Oh, thank you. Good evening. It seems to me there's qualitative distinctions in the nature of the type of relationship we experience in social media compared to what we do face-to-face. And we've touched on a couple of them this evening. But something I'm not sure has been touched on, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about, is the degree to which one of the significant things about friendship is how, and relationship, is how we allow ourselves to be impinged upon by other people, to have to make sacrifices for the people we know, or to be inconvenienced by them, to be affected by their actions. And there's something about social media which allows us to have a greater degree of control over that. Is there a risk that that would make us more selfish? Is there a risk that that would lead us to create norms around relationships where it's actually okay for us not to help each other out as much as we used to?
Okay, Professor Dunbar, if I can give that to you first, to this idea, does it cultivate a relationship that doesn't allow for the other person to be a burden?
It doesn't have to, I don't think, but I think it can more easily. And this kind of goes back to the distinction I was really trying to draw, that in everyday life, relationships really are kind of deeply emotional things. I'm not talking about romantic relationships, I just mean straight friendships, particularly with this inner core of five. And we don't really understand what those are. We don't understand why we have those relationships. But it's that underpinning, that emotional underpinning, that allows you to be behaves so nicely and altruistically towards your friends in particular. And I think our kind of worry we have yet to see is that if you have maintained relationships in the long term purely virtually, digitally, those friendships will die anyway. Nothing on earth will stop them, eventually dribbling away to nothing. And it's very important still to get back together again and meet face to face. But if the gap is too long, you just aren't going to have that, except, as I keep saying, these relationships you have now at this kind of university age. There's something really weird about the chemistry. It's all those essays you're writing. Yes, I didn't like to say that.
Professor Ward, this idea has been raised about burden and sacrifice for one another, and I mentioned before the words of Christ where he says, greater love is no one than this, that lay down one's life for one's friends.
I think we should idealise face-to-face relationships. You can be totally ignoring the other and not be responsible to the other in a face-to-face relationship. So, yes, I think there's a tendency in this, in the social networking, to be able to do that maybe more easily, to be able to be less accountable than you might have to be if someone pulls you up and says, are you really listening to me? But at the same time, you know, let's get it out of this one-to-one relationship and actually think in terms, to me, what would be more important is what impact does this have upon your own sense of a social responsibility, okay? Which is not just am I and you getting off with each other, but that's something much bigger, about an altruism which is much bigger in terms of a cause that's being served beyond just your one-to-one relationship and whether that's good or it's bad. And that comes back to what I was saying about this, about the capitalism of it. This has proved to be a way in which it can socially transform things, that it can, in fact, be more effective in bringing people together for a cause than, in fact, many of the ways we've actually been trying before, where student users have been sending out emails or they've been sending out posters, actually being text. I mean, I'll tell you one story. We had Joseph Stiglitz come to our university about 2 years ago, and we had the security all around the place because the students were demonstrating about the rise of fees at the time. And the president was very worried because we were giving him a degree and making a big fuss of him, etc. He didn't want anything disturbing that. So we were all told, all these buildings in this area are going to be closed down from midday, and we want the names of all people walking in and out of those buildings. All right. So we get to this celebration of Stiglitz, etc., in this central building, in this hall, and all these students came in, and the demonstrations was all round. Why? Because two students had managed to hide in the building, and they just actually got on their phones and mobilised a whole community around them. Now, that's powerful. And it's and whatever you think in terms of you know, as far as our president was concerned, it was just downright embarrassing. But in fact, in terms of, you know, they did that in order to open up the question, to actually force there to be something on the political agenda that otherwise could have just been totally ignored. So I think, in fact, we can't dismiss its power for social change. And if we're just looking all the time in terms of what does it do between the relationship between one person and another person, I think that's very narrow in terms of Christianity. It's a social vision. It's not just a vision between two people.
I recently read an article on technology and communication with the concept of high threshold, high return, low threshold, low return. And as you have been alluding to, a lot of social media tools represent a lower threshold, less accountability, less responsibility. Does this hold implications for the meaningfulness of human relationships? Are they lower threshold? And how would you recommend salvaging the inherent intimacy and face-to-face versus completely online interaction?
Finny. This is your one.
So I actually disagree. I don't think there's lower threshold by having online relationships. I just think that having 150, 200 relationships makes it impossible to have an in-depth relationship with every single individual. But the reality of it is, you know 150, you know 200 people in your life, and are you going to have meaningful in-depth relationships with every one of those people every single day, every single week? The answer to that is no. There's going to be a subset of people that you connect the most with. And again, I think it goes back to how much do you want to put into those relationships? Who are the key people that you want to invest in your life? And what does that really look like? Regardless of if it's online or if it's offline, I really don't think it's different. I think having it online gives you an additional way to communicate with them that you don't just have offline. But I really think that if we're just communicating with people online and not offline, we're missing the entire purpose of really humankind and what we're called to do as well.
Thank you. Nick.
We've spoken tonight about social networking sites as a neutral space, which might be influenced either in a positive direction or a negative direction. And certainly enough, we can talk about cyberbullying as much as we can talk about relief efforts that spread on Facebook. But do we have obligations in societal terms to ensure, given the popularity of these social networking sites and looking 5 years ahead, do we have obligations to ensure that they are used in a positive direction, and what are those obligations?
So I absolutely think we do have obligations as a society, and on the cyber bullying discussion in particular, I actually was going to talk about it a little bit tonight and didn't have a chance. Cyber bullying is a really interesting thing. So you have bullying that happens on the playground. Kids certainly can be mean and cruel. It happens with adults as well. They go after one child. But the point at which it's magnified and becomes a megaphone with social media is so much different than what we've ever seen. You have example after example of someone in high school post something negative about something. Then it goes out to 100 other people. Those 100 people send it out to 100 more people. And that reputation of that student is really damaged and really hurt. And so I think this is a really, really tough situation, which is where I go back to, I think we have a social responsibility, parents have a social responsibility, educators have a responsibility, and then we have a social responsibility to be able to say, you know what, this is not okay. I don't want to participate in this. This is not something that I agree to. And you're able to verbally voice that online in a way that you weren't able to do that in the past. And so I do feel like, yes, I personally feel like I have a social obligation in order to be able to drive that in a positive direction.
I suppose in this context, just the thought that's occurred to me, I mean, the technology equally offers the guys behind it the opportunity to monitor. and you know, and to catch that stuff very quickly.
Absolutely.
I mean, as the technology gets better, it can be caught even before it's gone out.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have visions of Big Brother and 1984 mm-hmm. watching you. So I just wondered, you know, are there options down that way for a kind of policing? I'm not sure policing is the right word, but kind of monitoring and controlling that don't risk us all becoming sort of subject to George Orwell 100 years later.
You know, there are certainly parameters and tools in place that are watching out for some of these things on Facebook and other social networks, but the reality of it is, to a certain extent, it's up to the community and the participants to be able to report things that are inappropriate behavior, and there's ways to do that, and I think that there's usually pretty quick call to actions when something gets reported. It usually gets evaluated pretty quickly. That said, I do really feel strongly that people have a social responsibility and moral obligation if they see something happening that should not be happening, that they need to do something about it.
I think there's one of the things that struck me about the question is that there's a lot of, there is education going. Mm-hmm. It's not just that there is that these things are happen and there's no reflection upon them. And part of the responsibility of the academic community, of the newspapers who kind of review things. I mean, just think there used to be a whole kind of worry about television. And then cultural studies began a kind of whole analysis about what's good television and what's bad television. So there becomes a good kind of a critical reflection that enables there to be levels of discernment. And I've seen this in looking at in schools at A-levels, for example. One A-level on religious studies was actually asking people as a question to look at three different internet sites and then to actually say which they preferred and why. In other words, not just to passively receive it, but to be actively engaged in that evaluation mm-hmm. of what's being received. And I see that is a responsibility that in fact all of us in education should be involved in.
Good evening. I was just wondering where ideas of empathy fit into friendship and community, especially related to social media. As Professor Dunbar mentioned, if 150 is the number of friends we can have, and that requires some degree of reciprocity. But then at the same time, you have a voyeuristic aspect of Facebook, or the fact that information can travel really fast on Twitter. So even though you might not be able to affect the conditions of, I don't know, a fighter in Benghazi or Misrata in Libya, you can empathize with the situation, or you can create a sense of community based on empathy. But is that enough to create a community, or does that require some sort of reciprocity as well?
Just before you take that, Professor Dunbar, just raise your hand, and Mary is around here and so on, so for the next question, but Professor Dunbar.
It's interesting, actually, because one of the enlightening features of all the work we've been doing over the last 5 years, a bit more maybe, 7 years, on the kind of social brain hypothesis, cognitive constraints, and on group sizes and so on, and the structure of social networks and so on, is we actually finally realised we didn't know what relationships were. We had no idea. And I think that's because, and it wasn't because we were all blokes either, I might say, because half of the people working on it were girls. I think it's because, you know, those kind of everyday face-to-face relationships really are emotional things. They're all based on, indeed, on empathy and that kind of thing. And it's kind of stuff which we can't access very easy to talk about. That's why we have such difficulty expressing ourselves. And I think why we appreciate poets so well, because they somehow just have the gift to put it into words and kind of elicit that sense, that emotional sense. And I have a sense, but we may be wrong about this, that to get those really requires face-to-face interaction, and you know, sort of, it's really difficult to do that on a very large scale. That's not to say that creating large-scale communities isn't important, and we have ways of doing it. In terms, dancing is very good, you know, and theatre is very good. Making people laugh is very good. One of the things theatre producers say is, an audience goes in as individuals and comes out as a community. right? So when you go in, you're kind of, well, at least anyway, in Britain anyway, we're kind of sitting like this, looking at the person next door. And then when you come out, especially if it's a comedy, you know, and you've laughed a lot, and you've had your emotions charged in a drama, you come out, you're telling your life story to a complete stranger in the foyer, you know? And that's creating that large-scale bonded community that these are the sort of mechanisms we use. But we're very, very struck by the fact that what seems, when we've looked at how the same people feel about the technology, different kinds of interaction, digital and face-to-face, that there is nothing to compare with the sense of buzz they get from a face-to-face interaction. Surprisingly, and we're comparing face-to-face against Skype, against phone calls, against texting, against social networking sites and so on, instant messaging. Face-to-face interactions always make you feel better. And one of the reasons, and surprisingly a little bit to me, Skype did very well. It did almost as well as face-to-face, but all the others were much lower. And it seemed to be due to a sense of co-presence. That's what Skype's doing for you. It makes you feel, it's that instantaneous feedback you get in a face-to-face interaction. That and laughter came out as the two key things that create this sense of whatever it is. It's some sort of deep emotional, empathic sort of sense, and it's very hard to. I think that this is really what the burden of my comment about virtual touch was.
Can I just add one quick thing? And you may have some additional input on this. So one of the things that you mentioned was the idea of being able to also reciprocate that friendship back and forth, which is really interesting to me, because when I think about reciprocation, I think of a friendship being unconditional, and there's times in which it's great to have that reciprocated back, but there's other times where you're just unconditional and you need to be there for someone and you don't expect anything in return. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have a viewpoint about...
Well, I was actually thinking about the empathy one, and that can, I mean, but it would be coming back to a very theological understanding of community. For example, you know, we can... within a kind of religious community, you could actually have a certain situation that you are being asked to do something about, for example, that you know nothing of. You've maybe seen some pictures of the conditions that people are living, and you empathize. And in fact, that becomes the mode in which you then move towards prayer. And that then is, theologically understood, then you're participating in a spiritual community and in the community of that tradition, whether it's the church or in Christianity or whether it was the synagogue. But you are participating in a different level of community, but that is no less empathy. You know, when I see certain things happening on the streets of Afghanistan or Libya, I empathize. I can't do anything with that empathy other than pray, because I don't actually know these people. But I do actually welcome the fact that this media can actually draw it to my attention.
Mary.
Hello. So I'm a PhD student here, and a lot of my friends are having babies. And I've noticed that I suddenly found myself in the position of knowing individuals whose first hour of their life is on Facebook. And I was actually wondering if you have any thoughts about how having your entire life documented on the internet, say from hour one, might influence not really the way you communicate with others, but the way that your own life is kind of communicated back to you, and how it might influence your own sort of self development and the development of your own personality.
Sounds like the Truman Show to me.
Ginny?
So I have two different points to that. One is whether or not I feel like there's privacy risks for doing that. And then the other point is you're being given a utility to be able to see what's happening in your life, be able to share that with family and friends in a way that you weren't able to do that before. Previously, you could video record stuff and send the recording on email, but now you can just do streaming on Facebook, or you can do streaming in other social media channels and mediums. And I think that that's really powerful to be able to share communities and bond with close families and family members and friends. That said, I'm still personally very cautious about what I put up in terms of photos and videos of my own family and my children, because I know they're very globally accessible, and I know that data exists infinitely out there. And I tend to be cautious about that and encourage people to be somewhat cautious about that. If there's something they post they wouldn't want someone to see, they shouldn't post it.
We can only do one more question, and I think, Phil, if you can be very brief with it, that would be...
I was just wondering what your thoughts were on new forms of exclusion that are perhaps created by social media. So for those who can't actually physically get to the internet or use it, but also for those who are excluded politically by a government that says, well, you can't go on Facebook, but we're going to let you go on RenRenWang or whatever media exists on our own country.
Make this the final comment. So, Professor Dunbar, I realise that the other question might have been of interest to you as well, but this point of exclusion or life being documented.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the documentation of everything has been a real problem. This is why a lot of the subsequent, I won't say imitators of Facebook, but you know, the sort of the second phase, like Path.com, which is the only one I know about, were explicitly started up to prevent or to allow you to share your photographs of children at school in a context where it was private, just to that group. And I think that's important. On the broader scale, I mean, the internet has made such a huge difference that, you know, most of us couldn't conceive the world without it now. And we couldn't do our jobs without it, for heaven's sakes. And to be denied it, in a sense, in a context where you could have it. It's not that you live in a very remote village and they can't do broadband there or anything like that. It just seems, you know, terrible.
Mr. Ward, I'll leave it to you to have the final word before I...
I didn't really have very much. What did strike me in the case with Egypt over the new year was, in fact, that they tried to politically close down all the internet channels, and in fact, it was mobile networks that actually got through. So again, I just see the fact that it's very difficult to own them. And to patrol actually can offer really good examples for how then governments can't just simply barricade and block out certain things. And that, I just think that the power of that is just so important, because we live in what we like to think is a relatively free place, but other people don't at all. And so that to actually be able to reach out to the outside world to let us know what that situation is, I think is really, really important. And that this is, to me, a tool that offers that possibility, that opens the world for all of us, really.
So that's us for this evening. And I just want to do a couple of thank yous and let you know about our couple of follow-up events before we close. This Saturday from 11 till 12, and you'll see this in your program, we have Veritas 2. It's called I Call You Friend, Fellowship, Discipleship and the Social Media Revolution, St. Michael's and Northgate on Cornmarket, and we're going to consider further from the Christian perspective, friendship, community and how social media are affecting these, and ask how the church should be engaging with social networking. And our second follow-up Veritas event is at the Graduate Christian Union next Monday night, and we'll be having three graduate students leading us into discussion, giving their thoughts on this evening's conversation and opening it up for you to give your responses also. We meet, as always, 7 for 7:30 p.m. in the Mitre Pub Upper Room, and details again are in your program, so I look forward to seeing some of you there. Many people contributed to this evening, but it would be remiss of me to not thank a few of our key supporters and the core committee. So the University of Oxford Graduate Christian Union, the Oxford Pastorate, Rachel Burke, Mary Catherine Caldwell-Stevens, Ilse Haven-Pittius, Kevin and Jennifer DePold, Kamal Wood, Jonathan Brandt, Ken Barnes, Dan Cho, and our Veritas Chair and Source of Frenetic Energy, Joseph Ho. To each of you, thank you. And finally, to our speakers, Professor Robin Dunbar, Professor Graham Ward, and Ms. Jenny Rutherford, I've learned a lot. I think some of my expectations have been turned upside down. And so I want to thank you for the conversation and hope that this has precipitated something in your minds to continue on in the weeks to come. Thank you and good night.